Mary is probably most well known for her soda pop can theory of postural stability, and I was expecting to focus on breathing and core, which we did a lot of, but that's really just a starting point. And after interviewing her, it is obvious why she has such a formidable and impressive reputation as a thought leader. Her thinking is clear, it's logical, she has an amazing ability to focus on the tiny details and the big picture at the same time, weaving together the multiple systems that contribute to motor function and honing in on the primary dysfunction, which, unsurprisingly, is usually several systems removed from the most obvious problem your little clients are presenting within clinic. So Mary is a well-sought-after international keynote speaker. She is an academic, she's a practicing clinician, and she fully intends to keep practicing until after she turns 100. I was hugely excited to interview her, a little bit nervous as well, but I was not disappointed, and you won't be either. You are going to love this interview. Enjoy. Mary, thanks so much for agreeing to do this interview. I'm so excited to be chatting with you today. I like to start off just getting a background of how you came to choose physical therapy as a profession, where it all started for you.
And I'm okay if you say physiotherapy. I know it's going to be hard to switch back and forth. We'll probably both use both terms. I actually knew I wanted to be a physical therapist from the time I was a teenager. And surprisingly, I got introduced to the idea of physical therapy and then never switched, which I don't know how often that happens. I've had two knee surgeries myself as a teenager, and so I was introduced to the field. My first experience was horrible, and my second knee surgery, I went to a different physical therapist, and I thought what she did was truly magical, and that magic was actually PNF. And right. I asked her, where did she learn that? She said, Northwestern University. And I said, okay, done. I applied to one school. That was it. I went to Northwestern because they had PNF. Dorothy Voss, who was one of the originators of PNF, was a faculty member at Northwestern for about 15 years. And she had just retired before I got there. So I didn't have her as an instructor, but I did have all of her first round faculty members. It was just a great experience.
I heard you do another podcast and you were talking about PNF, and it was so interesting for me because we kind of really did a basic introduction to PNF in my PT school. And for me, it was exactly what you said that drives you crazy. Just sort of patients lying supine and doing diagonals. So
complete waste of time.
So it was really interesting to hear your take on it. And it reminded me so much of how I think about NDT, where people think NDT is just, you know, reflex inhibiting postures, and how that drives you insane. It would be lovely if you kind of just spent a bit of time bridging that gap for me with PNF from the supine diagonals to where you've taken it and run with it.
Or how about even a little bit with PNF and NDT? Because both are incredible sets of tools for physical therapists as well as OTs and speech therapists. And if you don't understand the approaches really at their basic philosophies, it seems random. It seems like NDT is just about, as you said, reflex inhibiting postures, which should make anyone cringe in 2018. And PNF as random diagonals, and that would be the same thing. It should make you cringe. Both sets of approaches is really giving you a set of tools on how to approach a motor problem. I would say at its core, the difference between PNF and NDT, they're very similar. They were developed around the same time. But the biggest difference is that NDT tends to assist and PNF tends to resist movement. So which is the right one? Well, depends on your patient. At the very lowest level, they're really very, very similar because both are assisting, since the most resistance that a baby or a very sick patient could take would be assistance. In the long run, PNF moves to resistance sooner and probably a little more aggressive than NDT. They're both fabulous. My background is stronger in PNF because I went to Northwestern. I was a product of the 70s, so I graduated in 1977, and pretty much they hadn't invented orthopedics yet. Low back pain, when we took our classes, all low back pain was treated with Williams flexion exercises. It's like, but what if you need an extension? Oh, you don't need extension. Everyone with low back pain has the same problem, which of course is silly. But at the time, neuro was a much greater focus, and that's because physical therapy really was a product at that time that was focused on polio and the long-term effects of polio, and also the veterans who had survived wars, which were amputations. That was a real big part, as well as head injuries and spinal cord injuries. So then you start getting strokes, et cetera. So neuro was a very heavy emphasis in most of the PT programs. So it definitely started neuro. Ortho came later for me as orthopedics became better developed. And as I just recognized, this is insane. A body is made up of multiple body systems interacting together, and orthopedics is a huge component of that.
So I'm guessing a large part of your approach is at the body and structure level. And there's a big push in pediatrics, and I'm not sure so much in orthopedics or adults, but there's a big push in pediatrics to have a strong focus on participation and adapting the environment, and to move away from sort of manual therapy, alignment, range of movement, that sort of thing. Are you running into that at all?
That is such a loaded question, Mindy.
Sorry.
And that one just cracks me up. I love it when they say, just work on the kid rolling. Just tell him to roll more. It's like, if all I needed to say to a child with impairments was just try harder, then couldn't I just tell the parents, just tell your kid to try harder? That is like the parents who were insulted and devastated and crushed when their pediatricians would tell them, just try to feed your child more. As if any parent isn't trying to feed their child more when they have a sick baby. That would be the same thing for us. I think personally, it's ridiculous. If I don't have alignment, if I haven't addressed the impairments, if I haven't figured out what is the true underlying reason for that child to not be able to roll over, sit up, reach, talk, walk, pee, poop, sleep, to do all the normal participation, I can't get participation. That's the bottom line. If their spine is a mess, they can't lift their head. If their lungs are a mess, they're not going to eat. They're not going to have endurance. I must look at which body system is driving the motor performance, which will either limit or enhance their ability to participate and their ability to have health. So yeah, in case you notice a little passion here, this is, you pushed a hot button right from the get-go.
It's a hot button for me too, because I think it's our key role as physical therapists to be addressing body structure and function.
Absolutely.
Do you see that in the adult world as well?
Yeah, both adults and kids. And that, for us in the United States, it's quite a bit driven by insurance, which I don't really want to talk about because it really is very, very frustrating that someone who is not in our profession is actually dictating how we do, how we perform our professional tasks. So insurance would like it to be nice and clean and sweet. Did the patient walk? Or did they not? Well, they can't walk because of, oh, no, we don't want to hear that. We just want to know, did the patient walk? So our billing codes are such that you're rewarded for functional gains. But they don't care about the structure. They're also just insurance. That's finances. So it's completely different. And that's obviously just very opinionated on my part. But I feel if you get away from that and come back to looking at that patient, child or adults, I treat more pediatrics, although my pediatric patients are now, let's see, since I've been treating over 40 years, I have some patients who are 40 years old, and I look at them now and I go, I can't call you a kid anymore. So as we're looking at these patients, pediatric or adult, and seeing a motor impairment, the biggest issue that I tell therapists to look at, or the biggest approach, is to say, the question is not what do you see, it's why do you see it? Why do you see it? Is it really a shoulder problem? Is it really a knee problem? Or it's simply expressed that way? So you've got to look at your five basic body systems and say, where did the problem start? Where did it go? What are my current problems under each of those categories? And that will help me set up what is my priority today. And that's the bigger key, in my very humble, unbiased opinion.
I know your course is sort of 3 or 4 days of quite intensive information, but for people who don't know what you do, could you just give a bit of a synopsis?
So it's called If You Can't Breathe, You Can't Function, because that really is the basis of all movement and life, right? In my schooling, I'd never heard of cardiopulmonary before, and we had a fantastic instructor, Donna Fraunfelter. I don't know if any of the physios down in New Zealand have met her or had an opportunity to learn from her, but she's fantastic, and she is still teaching. So she was my last course in PT school, and she changed my life. When I was introduced to cardiopulmonary, or as you guys say, cardiorresp, it just changed everything, because it changed my focus from saying motor is king to saying actually physiology is always king. Physiology will always win. If you don't have physiology, you won't have motor. If you have physiology to support motor, then hopefully you can move from a surviving type of motor response into a thriving motor response. Maybe being able to have more variations in your motor patterns, maybe being willing to reach beyond yourself, maybe being able to explore recreation, etc. So when I got out of school, I started working in spinal cord injury right away at the Rehab Institute of Chicago. And from my very first day, I couldn't help but see cardiopulmonary everywhere. And I said, well, what do you guys do for the cardiopulmonary issues? I hear they all get pneumonia. Oh, yeah, they all get pneumonia. We send them to the acute care hospital. They fix them up and bring them back here. And I said, okay, I don't know anything because I'm a new grad, but if you know what's going to happen, can you try to prevent it? And they said, not really. They have spinal cord injuries. They're going to wind up with respiratory problems. So we're just working on seating and positioning and mobility skills, and you know, those who can walk, we're trying to help walk. We're trying to work on the neuro rehab here. But it never made sense to me to ignore the physiology. And it wasn't that extreme. It's just that that was kind of the underlying thought or prevailing approach to spinal cord injury. So from the get-go, I was looking more at physiology and how supporting the physiology may help to improve their potential for better motor performance. And that really took me into looking always at the body as a multi-system organism and looking beyond what the diagnosis was of spinal cord injury or lung disease or low back pain, and saying instead, what are the interactions between neuromuscular, musculoskeletal, cardiopulmonary, integument, internal organs? How are those all interacting together to either drive health and movement, or to make it harder to have health and harder to have movement? And that was really the genesis of the start of the course, is to look at how cardiopulmonary was influencing motor behaviors. And then it just became much bigger and much broader over the last 30 to 40 years. I was always driven to ask the question why, and to explore and research in the terms that we were researching in the day, you know, why did some patients get better and some patients not? And it seemed to me that what we were really missing as a key is looking at interactions between systems and, again, recognition that physiology always wins.
Right. And then you've just been on this path ever since of following the whole body systems approach.
Yeah. I mean, it was obvious to me. So I thought I must have just not been introduced to it. Maybe I was asleep during that class because it seemed so obvious. And I actually went back to Donna Fraunfelter about 2 years out of school. And I said, you know, she was my instructor. She was working intensive care in a different hospital. And I said, I'm either doing something really different, novel, and good, or I'm doing something really horrible and I need your guidance. So I talked to her about some of my ideas, and her response was, I want you to publish that in my next textbook. I'm like, okay, I think I might need something. And it's really been driven from that time. So from the late 70s forward, really looking at the biomechanics of breathing. Is it helping my neuro patients, my ortho patients, my cardiopulmonary patients? And looking just far beyond it, all those interactions of systems.
Did you have any pivot points along that journey?
Oh yeah, big time. And one is one that I still use as a case to today, because she was so influential in my thinking. And this was a little girl who had a spinal cord injury at birth. She was a breech presentation. She was pulled out feet first. Her neck was caught in the birth canal. Her chin was caught. And when the doctor pulled her out, he snapped her neck, and she had a C5 complete spinal cord injury. She was not treated with PTOT or speech for 3.5 years, because she had so many pneumonias and other respiratory complications that they actually never got to rehab. They were just constantly working on her lung health and nutrition health. And this would have been 1978, 79 at the latest, somewhere in the very late 70s. So a physiatrist is someone who specializes in rehab medicine, and particularly for the complicated cases. So this little girl would meet that criteria of not just having a spinal cord injury, but she's failed to thrive, repeated respiratory complications, nearly on a vent at all times, no motor development, very little speech, etc. She had not been referred to physiatry, which would be unusual in our practice settings, but that's because her pulmonology team thought that she needed to stay longer in their program. So our pediatric physiatrist eventually got word of it and essentially kidnapped her in a playful way to the rehab department. And she brought her to our unit and said, you guys better work some miracles, because I just told the pulmonology team that she had to come to rehab, and that perhaps the reason she's not getting better with her lung health is because we're not addressing her entire body, which of course makes so much sense. So at that time, there I am with very little experience, but a real focus right from the get-go on cardiopulmonary, and not just looking at postural drainage, which would have been the go-to in the late 1970s. And I had to look at Melissa and figure out the problem. Why? Why was she so sick? What could we do differently? And if you think of the body, the way that I look at motor performance and health is to look at neuromuscular, to look at musculoskeletal, to look at cardiovascular, pulmonary, and airway, to look at integument, scars, fascia, restrictions, and to look at the other internal organs, particularly gastrointestinal system, look at how those interact. So for Melissa, eventually I'm looking at it saying it started neuromotor. It immediately went to complicating her cardiopulmonary system, which then immediately compromised her internal organs, her whole GI tract, because she couldn't eat. So now she has constipation and reflux and failure to thrive. She's not going to move. She doesn't have nutritional energy, oxygen energy. So now she doesn't move. Gravity gets to affect her adversely. Now she has musculoskeletal problems. And the only thing she didn't have a problem with at age 3 was integument. And I think it's simply because she didn't weigh enough. She only weighed 12 pounds, which I think is about 5 kilos.
Yes.
Somewhere around there. So the poor little thing was so fragile because no one was looking at the entire sequelae. Where when you looked at her problems at age 3, you would then be able to say, or actually her primary problem at that point was internal organs. If we can't get some food, some nutrition, and some hydration in her, and this is before they had G-tubes, so you had to figure out a different way. We needed to make it a priority of the entire team to figure out a way to get calories and hydration. So internal organs as the top priority. Get them into her system so that I could help, because my area of focus was cardiopulmonary. So I would be that second priority from the team of developing an effective airway clearance strategy. And very importantly, looking at her biomechanics of breathing to say, what could she use even at age 3 and a half? How could she use the muscles available more efficiently in order to get to the next body system's priority, which would be musculoskeletal? So I'm going to have to do musculoskeletal because her spine is completely collapsed. Her chest wall is completely inverted from her work of breathing for 3 and a half years. And to be able to look at now positioning that alignment in order to allow finally the neuromuscular system to have the greatest function that she could have, even having a complete C5 injury. The only thing we didn't have to do in an active way at that point was to do anything with integument. Because at that point, we were just watching it.
Right.
Does that help to give a little better idea?
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the, so what did you do?
So what we wound up doing, for the internal organs, each one of the team members knew the top priority was eating and drinking, making it a priority that every single therapy started with eating and drinking. She always had to have two choices for eating, two choices for drinking, so that you could allow her to have choice, but the choice was not to eat or not to drink. Today you do a G-tube. It would be so much easier, but we didn't have that option. And if Melissa ever said any time during the session you had, could I have something to eat or drink, you were to stop because the top priority was eating and drinking. You had to allow her to focus on eating and drinking in small grazing types of activities. Then we looked at airway clearance. She was being suctioned 50, 60 times a day. It was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Every time you suction, you increase mucus production. And even as a new grad, I could look at that and see that. So I had to devise different airway clearance strategies, particularly manual assisted cough techniques that I developed for her that I still use today and that are still on the videos that that I sell, so that people can learn multiple different ways to do manual assisted cough techniques. So we had to look at breathing mechanics, had to get her pecs and sternocleidomastoid in particular to become primary movers, to be a force vector in the opposite direction of her diaphragm. Her diaphragm's pulling her chest wall in. Every single breath she took, which was still at 60 breaths per minute, was her default rate, which is absolutely absurd. So the poor thing, I would have been so exhausted, I think I just would have quit. If I was that poor little Melissa at age 3 and a half, I would have said, living is too hard. I don't think I can do it. Then you have to look at, well, how are you going to support her to be able to do that breathing? How are you going to be able to support her to possibly be able to talk and to eat? If you're not looking at her spine, then how is she ever going to move her rib cage? So we had to look at what support to give her. We went with a TLSO, a thoracolumbosacral orthosis, But my input on that is we can't do traditional because she is using her diaphragm at 100% of the effort and literally sucking her own chest wall in. So we cannot block her stomach, because if we do, she has nothing to breathe with. So we made a huge abdominal cutout and then put an abdominal binder over it to give her the dynamic support that you would need with breathing, allowing for visceral displacement, but still giving pressure support. So we use the TLSO, big cutout. Changed wheelchair. Actually, she was the first one we ever developed a power wheelchair for. She was the first one doing a ventilator eventually at home, because we went to nighttime ventilation. Today you would use CPAP or BiPAP, but that wasn't available. As we're looking at her need for 12 hours of sleep per day to be able to have not just rest to the respiratory muscles, but also positive pressure support from the inside to keep her chest wall up, so that we didn't reverse the pectus deforming forces that we had beautifully dealt with during the daytime. And just kind of looking at that, there were other things, but those are kind of in a nutshell with it by the end. So at age 3.5, she had been in and out of the hospital so much that they're guessing she might have had 12 pneumonias, or maybe it was just one pneumonia that lasted forever. Was suctioning 50, 60 times a day, a very limited speech, very quiet. She used maybe 1 to 2 words, very malnourished, eating very little. And in three months, we made dramatic changes that continued. I actually use her case. I have pictures of just about every patient I've ever treated, because I like photography. So you see Melissa's case change from being suctioned 50 to 60 times a day to being suctioned 0 to 2 a day. You see her going from deformities all throughout her chest wall and spine to actually reversing all of the deformities. That took years. You'll see her by age 12. Making dramatic changes. And this I published in 1991, so we're looking a long time ago. But the principles were so important to see that she got health, that she was able to participate. She's now in her 40s, and I just found her on Facebook. I haven't been able to contact her yet, but just looking at her pictures, like, she looks fantastic. And isn't that really the long-term goal that we want? Is to be able to take someone who was so impaired and say, let me help figure out for you, because you're not the physio, you're not the doctor, you're the patient. I know those impairments. What structures do I need to deal with in order to give you the potential to participate and you the potential to manage your health as best as your condition will allow?
My take from that is really kind of looking at the whole system and the whole team being very focused on working towards very specific goals. Right. Was that, when I asked you what was your sort of aha moment, what was it for you?
It wasn't treating a spinal cord patient, a patient with spinal cord injuries, as having just a neurologic impairment. If I did that with Melissa, I'm not sure she would have made it.
Right. Okay.
And it was from that experience with Melissa, when I had 1.5 years of experience, that changed the trajectory of my entire career. When I realized other people weren't looking at it that way, and that it's not hard to look at, but you have to have your eyes open to say physiology will always win. And even when physiology is nice and healthy at whatever level, depending on the pathology, you're still not going to get the greatest performance from your patients if you're not looking at how that physiology drives other motor performances and which other body system is still holding them back. Let me give you a good example. So you have a scar, you're a baby. You've had a lot of different surgical interventions because you were premature, you had this problem, you had that problem. You made it. Your physiology is stable. few. You're 8 years old, you're going to school, but you're still just having a hard time and your mom is yelling at you all the time to sit up straight. Sit up straight. What's wrong with you? Sit up straight. And if you're not thinking multiple system interactions and you as the physical therapist get a referral for a kid with poor posture who happens to be a preemie survivor, if you're not thinking about looking at integument and you don't realize that the chest tube that they had when they were having their congenital heart defect repaired, it's something as simple as a PDA repair, and their G tube, which had perhaps been done with an open incision, which would be a long vertical incision on the abdomen. You go back and look at the integument and see that they're restricted, and you're like, shoot, those two anterior restrictions from scars are pulling that child into a kyphosis and into a scoliosis. He can't stand up straight. He can't have maximal participation because his spine can't grow straight. Not because he has an anomaly to his spine, but because he has two functionally fused ribs in the front, secondary to the chest tube and the bridge of scar tissue across the two, adjoining the two surrounding ribs, and to the vertical incision on his abdomen, which has failed to move vertically because of adhesions. So the force is transferred to his thoracic spine, and he winds up with a thoracic kyphosis and a scoliosis, typically to the left, because that's where the heart surgeries would have been done.
Are you addressing it through functional movement? Are you addressing it through myofascial release techniques? What are you starting with?
Okay. Good question. You got to start with the impairment. Have to start with the impairment. I can't do functional movement on something that is impaired because they'll continue to use the compensatory pattern that had already given them trouble. If they had used compensations and it was adequate enough and they did great, they never would have been referred to me or to you. So if you're saying, here's that child who's 8 years old being yelled at for poor posture, and I assess his integument and say, I don't think this is musculoskeletal. I don't think this is neuromotor. I don't even think it's cardiopulmonary. The primary system of impairment is actually integument. So I can address it in terms of fascial releases, scar releases, but if that's not enough, I need to refer back to medicine. And I may be referring, as I would do here, to pediatric plastic surgeons to have them release some of the deep scar tissue if it's something that I can't do in terms of manual, non-invasive therapy. There would be a really nice article for your readers to read if they went to my website and looked, which is masserypt.com, and looked at my publications. I would recommend the Linda Crane article, because that's following a young boy with multiple congenital anomalies, following him from birth when he's on a ventilator, very sick kid, to the time that he's 15. And by the time that he is 9 years of age, his anterior scars had limited so much musculoskeletal growth and development that we had to start looking at doing surgical release of his scars. And afterwards, he could grow much straighter. Now, sometimes it's much more than PT, OT, or speech, and you have to say, shoot, I actually have got to get the docs involved here because it's beyond what we could do for through just our manual therapy.
Right. So again, it's really the whole team and the whole child. I'm wondering now that you have a couple of years behind you, what you've changed your mind about. So what did you used to believe quite strongly that you now kind of look at and no longer think is true?
Okay, first, Mindy, how cute. I have a few years behind me. Well said. Well said. So yeah, I've been practicing for 41 years and I feel I'm about halfway through my profession. At this point, my plan is to work until I'm 112 and then die at 113. So that gives me a lot of years in front. I wouldn't say so much it's something that I believed in strongly before that I've changed, as much as broadened. That's the difference, is just to look at whatever we did in the past, we did it with the knowledge we had that was available. And it's always that drive that you have to continually learn more and move forward. Don't stay stuck in something simply because that's the way I learned it. But by the same token, don't throw it out just because, oh, that's yesterday's news. You want to be constantly looking and saying, is this still valid and worthwhile clinically? And for me, the big push that I would like to see in the second half of my career is to be the bridge between physiologic medicine, thinking in terms of doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, and physical medicine, PT, OT, and speech. We need to be able to communicate better so that we can achieve what's really important, which is the long-term outcomes for our patients. If we only know our own little profession, we don't even necessarily know when to refer. So I like patients that have more interactions between the systems that maybe other people didn't notice. I love finding the hidden gem of we missed it. We missed it. You missed it. Somebody missed it. And that we need to take a different approach with a child. So here's a great example, toe walkers. I'm sure there's a million toe walking children who are toe walkers in New Zealand. And one of the things that I would challenge any practitioner looking at that child, again, did you screen all the body systems? Is it really secondary to internal organs? And what do I mean by that? So again, maybe it was a child who had some difficulty at birth, premature or not. They were struggling to survive. As soon as you have increased work of breathing, you have increased risk of reflux. Why? Well, because the esophagus and the trachea are tied together so that your GI system and your pulmonary system are always working together. You can't evaluate them separately. They go together. So if I have a child who's working very hard to breathe, they're going to create a greater pressure differential at the gastric junction. We're going to have more positive pressure underneath the diaphragm and much more negative pressure above the diaphragm. So you're much more likely to develop reflux. This is classic neonate struggling to survive. What are you going to see? The baby's going to have a noxious stimulus because of their reflux, and the brain is going to say, I need to get away from that pain. To get away from that pain, they're going to arch back into extension. If that pain persists because they still have reflux, it keeps happening over and over again, the stomach is on the left side. They're not only going to go into extension, but they're going to go into extension and right rotation. And with that extension and right rotation, you're now setting up motor plans that are going to influence them way beyond the NICU. So when I see a 5 or 8 or 10-year-old who's still toe walking, I'm going to be asking the medical history. Tell me about their birth history. Tell me about what happened to them early on. If that was part of their background, and I realized that perhaps a huge driving force in developing the motor plans, which would later become gait for this child, is aversion to noxious stimulus, then what that brain was learning was extension, and particularly extension right rotation, decreases pain. That's going to set up full extension responses. So when they start walking, what do you think they've learned? Don't even put your heel down. Everything is about extension, eye gaze up, right head turning. And then you see all these asymmetries in their chest wall. So I'll tell you what I start with by the time. So now I'm seeing them at 6 or 8 years old, their heart defect, their lung defect, their whatever it was is now cured. They're now, let's say, they're completely normal from a physiologic standpoint. But from a neurophysiologic standpoint, what their brain has learned is don't trust flexion. So they don't want their heels coming down. And what I wind up working on first is eye gaze. People go, eye gaze, are you crazy? It's like, yeah, because actually I have to get into their brain first. It's the neuroplastic change I need to make, not stretching their caps, the calves became tight because they were toe walkers, but they became a toe walker because of the early noxious stimulus, which drove them to a safe motor performance, which was very extension-based and often extension and right rotation. And I have had some kids, I had one just 2 weeks ago, and the parents were so funny because after all I did during the session was to work on his neurophysiology and neuroplastic drives. So it was all about eye gaze down and to the left, and bilateral upper extremity tasks with the arms down into shoulder extension, and particularly internal rotation, which blocks chest expansion. All those things are about flexion. His stomach was safe. He's not gonna reflux now. He's perfectly fine. I needed to show his brain he could really do it. So doing things with that eye gaze and his arms, and I never went to his legs. And afterwards, that child was walking heel to toe. And his mom and dad just looked and said, son of a gun, how'd you do that? We've been stretching his calves for 6 years. I'm like, well, if that would have worked, and it would have worked for some kids, if it would have worked, you wouldn't be coming here to see me. So I'm seeing those outliers. That's who I do see. That's who challenges me. I like the outliers because I enjoy the challenge.
That's so interesting. I have to be honest, when you start talking about all the different body systems, it can feel overwhelming. You know, there's so much that you have to consider and tease out and decide where you're going to start and how you're going to start with it. So do you cover that on your course, how to systematically go through all the different systems and tease out where the underlying issue is?
So just having you say that, I was going to say to you when you said, oh, it can be overwhelming, my point back to you was going to be, come to the course.
Oh, I am.
Everything is going to be about looking at how does the body function as a whole. And the main model that I use to explain that is a soda pop can. To say a soda pop can is pressurized, and that's what keeps that can strong. So if you look at that diaphragm in the center as not being a respiratory muscle, but rather being a pressure regulator, it changes your perspective because it helps you understand how reflux could be caused by increased work of breathing. If that pressure regulator, being the diaphragm, is moving more aggressively, it's going to change the pressure in the abdomen and the thorax to a greater degree in each cavity. In other words, the pressure differential above and below that diaphragm will be higher. Then it makes sense that, oh yeah, increased work of breathing will increase the likelihood that I will reflux. Doesn't mean you will, it just increases the risk. And that if I'm refluxing, I'm going to want to move away from that pain. That's when you can start to say, wow, I can see where the GI system can cause toe walking. I can see where cystic fibrosis causes pelvic floor dysfunction. Why? Because they cough a lot. And if they cough a lot, that pressure has to go somewhere. And if it goes down into the pelvic floor, because that's the weak link, the expression of cystic fibrosis for that child, or now that child being an adult, will be pelvic floor dysfunction. And when you look at it from that whole model, it's like, oh, of course cystic fibrosis could cause pelvic floor dysfunction. But then I want you to take it a step farther. Do you also see where that caused shoulder dysfunction? So go with me on this, Mindy. If my child with cystic fibrosis is now a teenager and really very healthy overall, considering her condition, and she's playing volleyball on her high school team, and she keeps coming to you with shoulder injuries, and you're trying to do just an orthopedic approach or musculoskeletal approach, we always say orthopedics or just ortho. So you're doing your ortho approach with that young teenager and trying to fix her shoulder mechanics, and you go, but she keeps coming back with shoulder problems. Why? And then you go back and say, well, shoot, I'm supposed to look at all these body systems. Where did it start? It started in cardiopulmonary with her cystic fibrosis, which changed her neuromotor plans for how to breathe. Since breathing and postural control are the same group of muscles, as I change her breathing mechanics, I also change her postural control strategies. If she's then coughing so aggressively and doesn't know to use that pelvic floor as part of her breathing mechanics and part of her postural control strategies, her pressure can be leaking through the bottom. So that when she goes to serve that volleyball and she needs increased intrathoracic pressure in order to stabilize her shoulder so she can drive the force through her distal limb, through her hand, into the volleyball, instead that pressure leaks through her pelvic floor. It leaves her shoulder vulnerable to shearing forces and injury. So if you actually work with cystic fibrosis, you're going to see a much higher percentage of those kids have shoulder injuries than their peers. And I would argue with you, it's not necessarily because cystic fibrosis caused the shoulder injury, but the sequelae of living with CF. So you had lung disease, you wind up with pelvic floor dysfunction, you can't keep the pressures regulated within your soda pop can, so you don't have enough ITP, intrathoracic pressure, to support your shoulder at point of contact, and it makes you vulnerable to injury. So in order to do shoulder rehab for that teenager with cystic fibrosis, I have to change their breathing mechanics and airway clearance program, which includes pelvic floor therapy, in order to have her play volleyball. Doesn't that make sense now? You just think of it, it's like, oh yeah, follow the chain.
Yeah.
Follow the chain.
It's amazing. So I'll just ask some questions then that therapist sent through. The first one said, I recently took the If You Can't Breathe, You Can't Function course. I learned a lot and have gotten a few sample abdominal binders from RCAI. I'm finding I want to put one almost on all my patients, but is that appropriate? What are your guidelines or recommendations for who is appropriate to use one? For my patients who have lower level motor control, it makes a lot of sense to use one. What about patients with more advanced motor skills who still have core weakness? Those are the ones I'm not sure whether it's appropriate for them.
Okay, that's a really good question. So if we're looking, we just talked about the soda pop can. If we're looking at postural control, it's all about control of pressure. So we need abdominal pressure support, IAP, and thoracic pressure support, ITP. So if we're looking at that, the main decision in whether or not to use some kind of abdominal binder or abdominal compression, if you would, any kind of garment that would give you compression, is can that child or that adult, can they generate adequate IAP themselves? Can they regulate that IAP themselves? And can they maintain it? The maintaining is the big line. Because I might have a child who could generate pressures, but they can only maintain it for a few minutes. It's like, well, then they need a binder. So it's going to be looking at whether they have lower cognition or higher cognition, lower motor performance or higher. If they can't generate, regulate, and maintain intra-abdominal pressure, then give them as much support as they need so that they can stabilize their lumbar spine through intra-abdominal pressure, give proper support for the rest of the breathing mechanics, particularly the alignment for the diaphragm and chest wall, so that you can open the potential for them to move. And then you can give them resistance right through whatever type of abdominal binder that you're using. They don't have to use it all day. If it's someone like little Melissa, she's going to have to use it with a spinal cord injury. She would have to use it all day because she has a spinal cord injury and she's not going to be able to generate IAP at all. But if it was someone like a child with Down syndrome, and then I might say, why don't you use it about 3 hours a day? Give them a little bit of support because they can't handle that pressure support all day long, generating it on their own. So give them support maybe in the afternoons when they're more fatigued. And as they get bigger and they get stronger, then just use the binder less and less. It's such an easy thing to use, and it's so cheap, and there's so many varieties of compressive garments. Why wouldn't you try it? If they don't get better, then don't use it. And if they do get better, make sure you have your outcome measures that you're looking at to determine whether or not an abdominal binder helped them. To just say, well, they're better. Better in what way? Is their gait more stable? Is their base of support more narrow? Can they lift their head up higher? Can they walk further? Can they walk faster? Do they have less balanced errors with a binder on? Is their voice stronger? Whatever that outcome measure is, make sure you're using that to determine whether or not the abdominal binder was effective.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a really important point about those outcome measures. The next question is, what are the core skills fresh PT graduates should work on?
Differential diagnosis, really. I find new grads are afraid, and I don't blame them. They don't want to screw up. They don't want to kill the patients. Don't be afraid to think. So if you see someone who has a shoulder injury, a knee injury, a spinal cord injury, cerebral palsy, don't say, this is exactly what I learned in school and this is the protocol, I must do it. What you want to look at is to say, that's the diagnosis. This is what I see. Why do I see it? Why? So that you can differentiate those who are the typical responders, where the average or more common interventions will be effective, versus those who will become those outliers. Why aren't they doing as well? So don't be afraid of doing your differential diagnosis, because it will take you far into your career to be far more effective as a clinician and far more efficient, because you'll be treating the problem from the get-go rather than just treating, I see there's a shoulder problem. Think of that just as we talked about that example with CF. You could treat the shoulder all you want. If you're not treating the pelvic floor and the airway clearance issues, you're not going to make her shoulder better long-term.
What do you think about the back to sleep campaign with babies? Do you think it impacts ribcage development?
Oh man, that's loaded. That is so loaded. Yes. I mean, we all know it's you don't want babies to die of SIDS. That is the most important thing. But going completely to the back to sleep program, we've all seen dramatic changes in delays in normal gross motor acquisition of skills in the first year of life. They do appear to catch up by about the time they're age 7. There's been some recent publications on that. But very clearly, the kids are no longer rolling at age 3 months. They're rolling at 6, and sometimes not until 9 months, and many of them not reaching out beyond their supine or just sitting position. So that we know. Chest wall development, yes, big change as well. It used to be that infantile shape, which was more triangular shape, narrow at the apex up towards the neck and very wide and barreled down towards the base, very horizontally aligned as neonates. We used to see the changes beginning in chest wall shape at 3 months of age, as the babies were in prone doing constant baby push-ups, and you would see a rectangular shaping in that chest wall, certainly by about 3 months of age. And I'm no longer seeing that till about 6 months of age. They just don't spend enough time in prone to physically change their rib cage. Like the gross motor skills, it does catch up later. And so probably for the typically developing child, although I find it annoying, is probably fine. But for my kids who are more fragile, who don't have breast support, who have also had medical problems, it's a huge issue. It's a huge issue, not only because of the change in the delay in normal chest wall development, but also the lack of stimulation to engagement of the glottis as a postural stabilizer. We haven't even talked about the glottis. There's so much more, Mindy. We could go on for 10 hours.
Yes. I think that's why people have to come to you, of course.
They're going to have to come, of course. There's 20 hours. No, 20. I think it's 28 hours, because when I teach it abroad, it's always 4 days. I don't want to cross some big pond and not have enough time to teach. But guaranteed, we will run out of time. We will run not just you and me in an interview, but in the course.
Yeah.
I can also guarantee that I'm going to change their practice. It does not mean throw out what they're doing. It means broaden. Broaden that perspective. Why do you see what you see? So just thinking of that sickly baby who's getting a little better, but they're in the back to sleep program, but they're at respiratory risk because of whatever their early experience or pathologies were. They're lying on their back. They're not doing baby push-ups. They're not learning to use their glottis, not only for speech, but they're not learning to use it as a postural stabilizer. So if they're not doing push-ups that require more intrathoracic pressures because they're trying to lift up and raise their head up and grab the toy or look at mommy's face, they're actually not getting the stimulus, not only for chest development, but for the very important part of the whole top of that soda pop can to develop from the support of the lower portion of the soda pop can. So I see huge delays in spinal control and upper extremity function and head control, perhaps swallowing and oral feeds because the babies were sleeping on their backs. Again, I don't want the babies to die of SIDS, so it's very hard for me to say, well, let's just put them all back in prone, because we have seen a dramatic change, a dramatic decrease in the incidence of sudden death, which is obviously the most important outcome.
Right.
But we've got to find a way to be able to get these kids to have more experience in prone and to be able to have that full body development at an earlier age, particularly the kids with respiratory risk.
So that just makes me think about our more involved kids, like our GMFCS 4 and 5 kids, mm-hmm. with nighttime positioning,
right.
and that sort of thing. Is that something you advocate?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things we will do in the course of showing the group a case of Matthew, who has cerebral palsy. He's just a great kid, very social, but he couldn't push. He could pull, but he couldn't push. And that's classic, isn't it? For our kids who are very involved, we say that
Absolutely.
They can pull their arms in, but they don't push very well. They also didn't get much prone experience. Their heads are also, relative to their teeny tiny little bodies, enormous. They don't have hydrocephalus. It's just simply that the lack of the muscle tone and so many nutritional aspects, et cetera, when they were little and premature. So we think it's just that, and we think it's just the cerebral palsy. It's like, it's not. They actually can push. You just got to give them support. And without the pushing, I'm not going to engage the glottis. And without the glottis, I don't have ITP. And if I don't have ITP, I don't have head control. These are just building blocks. You know, when you just look at it, it's like, all right, I'm building a tower with little ABC building blocks. If I don't put them straight on top of each other, then maybe I can only get 3 before they crumble. But if I actually pay attention to alignment, maybe I could get 7 or 8 on there before that tower would crumble. So yeah, I think it's actually huge. And I'll be talking about my research on glottal control, which I actually did over in Australia with Paul Hodges. And that was through my university here, Rocky Mountain University in Utah. That was my doctoral dissertation. And again, I hope I just truly change their focus to say, I never thought about the glottis as a PT or OT. Isn't that just speech? It's like, it's not just about communication. It's a huge part of limb force production, that ability to push and bear weight through my limbs, the ability to lift my 5th limb, which is my head, and to be able to make the greatest use I can through my body, even if I have cerebral palsy. It's really fun to see his case from 1.5 to age 8.5. I think they're going to be blown away.
That's amazing. Can you bring that back for me to nighttime positioning?
Mm-hmm. So nighttime positioning, you want to be thinking of what are those forces of gravity on their chest wall? What are their breathing mechanics? We know that if you're not sleeping well, you are also not functioning well during the day. There's so much literature now in sleep disordered breathing. So for each child, you've got to look at that child. There is not one size fits all. What are their motor impairments? What are their breathing mechanics? Are they better off on their back, their side, their stomach? And it means you actually have to evaluate it. I can't tell you the answer because there's not a single answer. It's that it is part of your entire motor performance. And when you're looking at positioning, you're looking over 24 hours, not just the time you see them in therapy or the time you see them in school. Yeah, absolutely. We'll be talking about nighttime.
I am really excited, Mary, to be doing your course, but I wonder if we could finish off with you telling me what you're excited about right now. What's kind of pushing your buttons?
I think where we're going in the future, I think there are several things that will be more of a focus in the next 20 years. One, hopefully people are doing a better job of looking at the multi-system interaction. But within that, I think integument is a huge issue. Just all fascia, from just fascia around the organs to fascial glide. So we're looking at both the stability of different organs and muscles because of good fascia, as well as the ability of the fascia to glide one on top of the other, as well as tethered scars. I think it's going to be routine parts of all therapists' evaluations looking in the future. And I also think internal organs in general, looking at all the viscera. We look mechanically at everything else. We look at the knees and shoulders and back, but we don't seem to look at the internal organs from a mechanics viewpoint. I think that's going to be much more a part of the everyday curriculum. And lastly, what I hope to change is how we actually look at the idea of core. And that's what I would like to see, again, looking forward in the next 20 years, to say people won't look at core and say, I need to activate the transverse abdominis. Instead, they say, I need to look at the entire pressure system. Do they generate, regulate, and maintain pressure from the vocal folds on the top all the way down through the diaphragm to the pelvic floor? And to be able to figure out the impairment to their core stability by looking at a model that is much bigger and broader. I think that will truly change practice.
Thank you so much for that. And if you could just tell everybody who's listening how to find you or find out about your courses, that sort of thing.
Well, luckily now with the internet, it's so much easier, isn't it? It's just, yeah. We're so lucky. They can find everything on my website. So my website is masserypt.com. So that's M-A-S-S as in Sam, E-R-Y-P-T, all one word, .com. And they can find out about my courses. I've got video clips on there that they can look at under course videos to just get an idea of what I teach, as well as a listing of all the courses I teach, what's involved with it, publications, faculty, just there's clinics, a whole bunch of information. And I'd love to see any Kiwi in any course of mine because I love your accents. They're so cute. And you're just such a cute blend of South African and Kiwi accent. I like it, Mindy.
That's funny. I lived in the States for a year, Mary, in upstate New York. And I was just telling somebody the other day that all anybody has to do is speak with an American accent and I love them straight away.
It's so funny because for us, Americans prefer Kiwi and Australian accents we just think are darling. And if you're a teenage boy and come over to the United States, for sure, you're going to have girlfriends just based on your cute accent. it's like you say, you like someone straight away with an American accent. I would say the feeling is mutual both ways.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Okay, so we will wrap it up there. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Mary. I've so enjoyed this conversation and I can't wait to meet you in March and learn from you. I hope you enjoyed that interview. You'll find links to everything we discussed in this interview at wiredondevelopment.com. And if you haven't already, whilst you're there, you can sign up for the Seriously Smart Snippets. These are bite-sized emails delivered weekly to your inbox with useful snippets from past interviews to enhance your learning and keep you inspired. Thanks for listening, and a special
thanks to those of you that take the time to connect and send me your thoughts and feedback. It really does make my day. Cheers.